Nicolas Maduro is locked up in a U.S. federal jail. Meantime, in Venezuela, a crackdown against any would-be critics.
This is really sort of like a warning shot and also a message, frankly, from the authorities in Caracas that this is not a change in regime.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. How Team Maduro is very much still in control.
Also today, Nigeria has the world's largest unvaccinated population. A historic effort is now underway to change that.
This campaign is using that opportunity to ensure that no child is left behind.
In Birmingham, England, a labor dispute that's nearly a year old has turned very smelly.
From one side to another, this road is completely full of rubbish.
Why garbage collectors are refusing to go back to work. All that and more today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for joining us this Tuesday. Venezuela's main opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, says she will return home to Caracas as quickly as possible. Speaking with Fox News from an undisclosed location, Machado praised President Trump for toppling Nicolas Maduro. She also said that her movement is ready to win in a free election.
On the streets of Caracas today, armed militia groups are on patrol. They're stopping citizens to search their cell phones. Hardline Interior Minister Diosdado Cabello shared a video of himself flanked by men with guns. The militiamen there are shouting, "Loyal always, traitors never." Elizabeth Dickinson is the Latin America Deputy Director for the International Crisis Group. She's in Bogota, the capital of Colombia, one of Venezuela's neighbors. When I reached her earlier today, I started by asking whether Venezuela was indeed, as one government spokesperson described it, completely calm.
Unfortunately, in recent hours, what we've seen is the deployment, essentially, of some security forces together with basically local community militias that have backed the government in Caracas for some years, essentially patrolling the streets. Yesterday, they issued an emergency decree saying that these forces have the ability and indeed the order to urgently seek anyone who has either supported the U.S. attack or promoted it. And that latter point is really important, because this could be something as simple as having a news story on your phone related to what has happened. There's a lot of concern at the moment about simply going out on the street to do one's daily business.
Because these security forces are stopping people and asking to check their phones to look for evidence, right? And then what happens if they find anything? Are they thrown into jail?
Well, exactly. And I think, you know, this is really sort of like a warning shot and also a message, frankly, from the authorities in Caracas that this is not a change in regime. That is clearly the message that's being sent. We don't have clear reports about what would be happening to civilians who are picked up yet. But yesterday, roughly a dozen foreign journalists were picked up on the street. Some of them were held for 2, 4, 6 hours speaking with security forces and again, having their phones checked. These foreign journalists were later released, all of them. But I think, again, this is a really chilling message about what the freedom and level of expression will be going forward in Caracas.
Has there been a marked shift in sort of what people are thinking and saying and feeling since, you know, in the past couple of days? There was perhaps guarded optimism after Maduro was removed. Correct me if I'm wrong there, but has that changed in the past couple days?
I would say the majority, really, of at least those we've spoken to in Venezuela were relieved to see the back of Maduro. Of course, a person who's been involved in crackdowns on the opposition, holding flawed elections. You know, no one was sorry to see him go. But I think from the very first moments, and this was reflected in that eerie calm on the streets those first days, there has always been this concern about, okay, but what next? Because essentially, Maduro's removal has left the entire rest of the regime in place, including the hardliners who organized those crackdowns in the past. So, you know, I think Venezuelans understand that dynamic very well and are proceeding with caution because they think it's quite clear already that, at least for now, none of the fundamentals of a repressive regime have changed.
Right. So Venezuela's former vice president, Delcy Rodriguez, is now the current leader. She presides over the military. Is it clear that she is directing this crackdown, or are there other regime forces that are more in charge?
You know, Delcy Rodriguez's, at least her reputation and portfolio up till now, has been really focused on the economic and oil sector. And there are other sort of pockets of power within the government that are very much control of the security forces. And this would be particularly probably the Minister of Defense and also the Minister of Interior Affairs. Those two individuals control essentially the security forces and have proven time and time again that they can keep those soldiers and police and militias unified despite outside pressure.
And so does that mean that those two officials are the ones sending militias and paramilitary troops out into the streets to crack down?
We certainly don't know sort of, you know, the exact chain of events that led to how this emergency decree was issued. But now that the emergency decree is out, this is, you know, the official order for security forces on the ground. The government of Maduro, it was never one person. You can think of it sort of like a living organism with different parts that function in different ways and have different powers and control different parts of the state. And all of that infrastructure is still there. And so those who are in the defense sector and have this sort of very hardline position towards anyone who would raise their voice against what's happening in Caracas, they're still there.
Right. They're still there. They're still, you know, folks sending folks out into the streets. Are people in Venezuela able to go about life as usual right now, or are they kind of laying low?
I think a lot of people are staying inside as a precaution. Certainly in the initial hours after the attack, actually, we saw some longer lines, for example, at pharmacies and supermarkets, you know, looking to get basic necessities out of this, you know, innate fear or sense of caution as to what might happen. We understand that more shops are open in the last 2 days. But again, I think, you know, the word here is caution and concern.
Hmm. You mentioned that the Interior and Defense Minister have proven that they are able to keep their people, their soldiers, unified, even facing foreign threats. But there was not much of a fight put up when Maduro was captured by U.S. troops. How do you square those two facts?
Well, exactly. You know, I think that the Venezuelan security forces, the military and otherwise have known from the beginning that they had no way to combat the U.S. military. They're simply not fit for the task. But what they had in place was indeed a plan of essentially asymmetric resistance. So activating militias, arming some civilians, planning protests, you know, those sorts of sort of resistance actions were fundamental to the response plan that the government had in place prior to the U.S. attacks on Saturday.
There are calls for the Venezuelan government to release political prisoners. Those have not been acted on yet. Who are those political prisoners? How many are there? And what's their likely future?
So according to civil society, the last count that we have at the end of December, it's 863 people that we know of. Of those, about 175 are military officials. And this actually gets back to your question about how the security forces have maintained cohesion through outside pressure. The answer is through repression. Soldiers who have been loyal are rewarded, for example, with more resources, food baskets, redistribution. And those who have spoken up or resisted find themselves in a very difficult situation of you know, being arrested and worse. Others are civilians. Of course, we know many people from the opposition, activists. But frankly, it can be, as we started out this conversation, you know, anyone who happens to have the wrong message on their phone at the wrong time.
You mentioned that this type of crackdown, sending soldiers into the streets, has happened before. Is there any indication of what might come next based on history?
The expectation, and frankly, I think a significant risk going forward, is frankly that there could be a regime consolidation. That in fact, the result of removing Maduro could be that those who are even more hardline within his government are empowered to take further reins of control. And I think until we see sort of a transition plan, and particularly, I think, a broader voice for how Venezuelans will be included in that transition from the United States, I think there are a lot of questions and, frankly, a real concern that that could be the outcome of what has happened. You know, in the coming weeks, I think we need to be very, very vigilant about further arrests, about freedom of expression, the ability of Venezuelans to go about their business, and, frankly, also economic collapse.
Elizabeth Dickinson is the Latin America Deputy Director for the International Crisis Group. She joined us from Bogota, Colombia.
Garbage workers in the English city of Birmingham have been on strike for almost a year now. The walkout has left local residents dealing with piles of trash and, not surprisingly, a growing rat problem. Workers first went on strike last January, protesting proposed changes to their jobs and pay. Now, a year later, there's still little sign of resolution. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry tells us more.
Basman Khan began posting TikTok videos of the street outside her home last March, where black refuse sacks packed with rubbish were piled high.
And it has now increased unbelievably. The pathway has got narrower and narrower, and it has now come all the way around to Somerville Road.
9 months later, Khan, a mother of three, is still posting videos from her area of Small Heath in Birmingham.
So from one side to another, this road is completely full of rubbish, and there's no excuse. I don't care what anybody says, there's no excuse. We need help.
Today, she tells me she can't believe she's still out there making videos almost every day.
I'm actually very, very shocked that a local authority can allow it to drag on for so long. I mean, why would you allow such actions to escalate?
Last January, refuse workers found out the Birmingham City Council was planning to cut certain job roles. The council said the decision was in line with national practice and was aimed at improving its waste collection service. Workers will be offered alternative positions, but on lower pay, a drop of around $11,000 a year. That represents a 20% cut in salary. The workers voted to strike.
It's about pay cuts. It's not about people asking for more money. It's purely about people saying they can't afford pay cuts.
One Kassab is with Unite, the workers' trade union. He says talks between the two sides broke down last summer.
This could have been resolved a long, long time ago. And the only reason why it hasn't been resolved isn't because we've been turning down offers. It's simply because the council are now refusing to negotiate.
The council has said the pay reduction was needed to even out salaries after the passage of an equal pay law. It declined my request for an interview, but in a statement said it was committed to reaching a negotiated settlement and that fair and reasonable offers had been rejected by the workers' union. Garbage workers haven't been paid by Birmingham City Council for almost a year. They rely on compensation from their trade union, but it's 20% less than their usual monthly wage.
It's really bad. It stresses on the family as well.
Matt Reed has been a bin worker in Birmingham for 20 years. And has been on the picket since last January.
You're trying to explain to your family why you're making this stand. And they don't all understand. They just can't see that why would you put yourself through this much stress, this much pressure. And they can't see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Reed has a 17-year-old daughter who's hoping to go to college this year. Her college fees will be around £8,000, roughly $11,000. The same amount the council plans to cut from his pay. Take that away, he says, and she won't be able to go. 12 months of striking has made the workers more determined than ever.
As strange as it sounds, the longer it's gone on, the more resolute people are. It has become that. We've come this far. We can't just give in.
The council hired temporary agency workers to carry out refuse collections, but recycling bins haven't been picked up since the strike began. Environmental campaigners worry it'll set recycling habits in Birmingham back years. Local resident Basman Khan says that's not the only problem.
Well, basically what it has is given a green light for people to behave however they like in terms of their rubbish. So whether that's just dumping it by the tree or by a bus stop or on the end of the road, it just escalates. And one person thinks, oh, they've done it, I'll do it. And I think it's also got so big, I don't even think Birmingham City Council know how to handle it.
Birmingham City councillors are up for re-election in May, and in the coming months, they'll be knocking on doors, canvassing for votes. This bin strike may have political consequences too, Khan says. Come next May, bin workers may not be the only ones out of a job. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
You're with The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In East Africa, there is a nation of Somalia, and then there's Somaliland. It's a tiny territory within Somalia that broke away some 34 years ago as a semi-independent state. No other country in the world has seen it that way, though, until about a month ago, when Israel became the first nation to officially recognize Somaliland. Today, Israel's foreign minister landed there to meet with its president. We wanted to know what all this means and why this territory is seen as strategic. So we spoke with Omar Mahmoud, a senior analyst at the International Crisis Group based in Mozambique.
Somaliland is basically the northern part in the Horn of Africa. Once the government in Somalia collapsed in 1991, Somaliland declared its independence and has gone its own way ever since.
Yeah, so just to put a little image in people's minds, Somalia, the country, looks a little like the number seven, and it's that top line of the seven, that is Somaliland. So it declared its independence more than 30 years ago. It has its own government, its own president. Why has it not been widely recognized as an independent country?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there's always been this idea that, you know, support to the Somalia government will lead to a stronger government, and that will lead to eventual negotiations with Somaliland, and this issue will get resolved one way or the other. But the reality is that just really hasn't happened. You know, most countries, their attention to this part of the region is more rooted in security concerns. There has been.
So it seems Israel has made quite a significant step then, becoming the first nation to recognize Somaliland. Why did the Israeli government take that step?
You know, I think there's probably a couple reasons, and it all relates back to Somaliland's geostrategic position. It's on the Gulf of Aden, leading in to the Red Sea and essentially across from Yemen. And so Israel's had, you know, a couple different conflicts regionally, a couple different adversaries regionally over the past couple of years. But one of them is the Houthis, which are based in Yemen. So having an ally in Somaliland would give them, you know, some sort of a base to operate from. Then the other side we see now is an increased interest in the wider Red Sea space. We've seen increased geopolitical competition in that space. And I think that's what Somaliland's leverage to get to now to this point of recognition.
So what's been the reaction in East Africa to Israel's decision to recognize Somaliland? Start with Somalia itself.
Well, Somalia has particularly been quite upset about this. We saw a similar situation a couple years ago where Ethiopia had come to an agreement with Somaliland about potential recognition. And what we saw from Somalia was it went into overdrive diplomatically to condemn that sort of move and put pressure on Ethiopia. We're seeing a similar a playbook right now. Basically, the reaction has either been very strongly in line with Somalia. That's Djibouti has been there and Eritrea has been there. Or it's been one where actors haven't kind of waiting and see how this all plays out, and they haven't really taken such a strong position just yet.
I see, though, that the African Union and even wider China and Turkey, they're not happy with this move. So this seemingly has impact beyond the region.
Yeah, I mean, essentially what this does is, you know, the Somalia-Somaliland dispute is a local issue that's being elevated to, you know, a regional, if not international stage at this point. The concern, though, is that hardens positions rather than ever getting to, you know, a position where Somalia and Somaliland could dialogue. If they have all these outside actors lining up on one side or the other, it divides the region and allows the local actors to take kind of more stronger, uncompromising positions.
So Somaliland's president has said his country will join the Abraham Accords and officially recognize the State of Israel. Connect the dots for us. What would be the role of Somaliland and the Abraham Accords?
So the point of joining the Abraham Accords is probably twofold. One, there's a number of countries that are already part of that then, you know, Israel could lobby them as well to have relations with Somaliland. You know, they're all kind of maybe part of this similar bloc. The second part is, of course, the U.S. administration, the Trump administration, you know, is fond of the Abraham Accords. They want to expand it. And so I think it's a way for Somaliland to also attract U.S. attention.
Yeah, well, some of President Trump's Republican allies have pushed for a deal with Somaliland, but Trump himself has said he's not intending to recognize the country anytime soon. So we're talking U.S. lawmakers now, minus Trump. Where does the U.S. stand on all this?
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. has traditionally had sort of a almost unspoken one Somalia policy, which means that they engage in Somaliland, of course, but not to the point of recognition. A lot of what their support has been to Somalia has been run through the government in Mogadishu. And most of this has been tied to counterterrorism concerns. That's been the status quo. And where the push has come has been more from some Republican lawmakers that have picked up the Somaliland cause and have seen it, you know, kind of in that light that it makes more sense for U.S. interests to gravitate towards Somaliland. Part of this is also frustration with Somalia and the government in Mogadishu. The fight against al-Shabaab, you know, drags on. And so I think that status quo mentality is more or less there, but it's been increasingly challenged.
So, Omar, we've been talking about the role that Somaliland can play for other countries, but what about Somaliland itself? What do the people of Somaliland want?
Well, I mean, there's been a lot of outpouring of support for this recognition bid. They argue their lack of recognition cuts them off from international financial markets. You know, it puts them in a precarious position. It inhibits international development and these types of programs. I mean, you do have a segment within kind of diaspora Somalilanders that still do believe in union with Somalia. But I'd say, you know, the majority of the population is young, has grown up since 1991, has never really known the union. But the question then comes to, you know, more practically, just a resolution of the issue one way or the other so they can also kind of get on with their lives. Otherwise, you know, you're kind of always trapped in limbo.
Omar Mahmoud is with the International Crisis Group, giving us some context about Somaliland and why Israel became the first country in the world to recognize it as independent.
And now let's catch you up on a few things you might have missed.
Japan's iconic bullet train, the Tokaido Shinkansen, set a new ridership record on Sunday. More than 500,000 people rode the intercity line that day. The Shinkansen typically sees an increase in passengers around the holidays, but just like other transit systems worldwide, ridership decreased during the pandemic and has not recovered, which makes this new bullet train record something of a surprise.
And another surprise, in Thailand, an endangered feline species has just been sighted for the first time in 30 years. The flat-headed cat, known for its short tail, rounded ears, and, as you might expect, flat head. It was spotted in a local wildlife sanctuary, according to authorities. That's great news for those who feared that the species was extinct, giving some hope that the population of flat-headed cats might recover.
And in Munich, Germany, debate over surfing in the city's English Garden. Accumulated debris once created a 3-foot-high wave in the river that runs through the park. That debris was cleared by city workers, and with it went the surfable wave. Over the holidays, some renegade surfers installed a wooden beam in the river to bring the wave back. Once again, the city removed it.
Surfers, they can never catch a break. Those are a few things you might have missed.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Representatives from more than 30 countries met in Paris today. They were there to talk about Ukraine, even as tensions were high over events in Venezuela and renewed U.S. threats to take over Greenland. The group referred to itself as a coalition of the willing, out to make concrete plans for Ukrainian security. The U.S. was represented by Special Envoy Steve Witkoff and President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner.
As the meeting wrapped up this afternoon, French President Emmanuel Macron explained to reporters that a coordinating body would be established in order to achieve the aims of the coalition. Here he is speaking through an interpreter.
Long-term support, firstly to Ukrainian armed forces that are and will remain in the front line of defense and deterrence against aggression.
Macron also made an even bigger commitment on behalf of this coalition in a still hypothetical post-ceasefire Ukraine.
Then we'll continue to lay the ground for the creation of a multinational force in the air, on the seas, and on land.
Here's Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky explaining that to reporters, heard here through a BBC interpreter.
And we want to be ready so that when diplomacy reaches peace, we can place the forces of the coalition of the willing.
In other words, be ready to enforce a ceasefire. Or as UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer put it,
the purpose of the coalition of the willing is to help deliver a peace that can last.
We'll continue following the story and bringing you updates.
Nigeria is on its way to vaccinating more than 100 million young children. It's the single biggest vaccination campaign Africa has ever seen. Already, tens of millions of kids across Nigeria have been vaccinated against measles, polio, rubella, and yellow fever. As the project enters phase two this month, it will target other diseases too, including malaria. Chizoba Wonodi is a Nigerian health expert at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Global Health. Wonodi is working on the vaccination campaign in Nigeria.
We want to vaccinate children from the ages of 9 months to 14 years with the measles rubella vaccine, and at the same time introduce the vaccine into the routine immunization program. Nigeria has had measles vaccine in its program, but not rubella. So this is an opportunity to bring in the rubella vaccine to protect children from, you know, infection with rubella, which is a mild form of measles, but the challenge with rubella is that when pregnant women are infected, their children can, their newborns can come down with what we call congenital rubella syndrome, which includes things like, you know, kids being born with a hole in the heart or being blind or deaf. So this is a very important milestone for Nigeria to be able to protect children from this devastating condition.
And those very serious effects of children born to mothers with rubella. There are other diseases, too, that this vaccine program is paying attention to, including, what, yellow fever, polio, and malaria?
This vaccination program is unique, not just in terms of its size, but in the fact that it's integrating vaccination of other diseases that we would usually have in the routine program. Like you said, polio vaccination, that was done in the phase one in the northern part of the country. So there are two phases to the vaccine, phase one and phase two. We just completed phase one vaccine campaign, and that included the measles rubella, polio vaccination, and then interventions against what we call neglected tropical diseases, such as parasitic infections that affect children and cause malnutrition and poor growth outcomes. So we have done that with phase one. And then in phase two, one of the states is also going to introduce the malaria vaccination as part of the measles rubella integrated campaign.
So the rubella vaccine is totally new for kids in Nigeria. Are all of these other vaccines things that, you know, ideally they would have gotten in their normal vaccination schedule, but this program is catching up those who have not?
Absolutely, yes.
What are vaccination rates in Nigeria for, let's say, those nine childhood vaccines that are part of the typical schedule?
The main indicator we use for routine immunization is what we call the Penta-3 coverage rate or DPT-3 coverage rate. The most recent survey for Nigeria puts it at 67%.
So about two-thirds of kids have all their vaccines.
Yes, absolutely. There's another indicator, which is zero dose, like I mentioned earlier. That's the proportion of kids who have received no vaccination at all. Unfortunately, Nigeria has the highest number of zero-dose children in the world, and this campaign presents an opportunity for the government to catch up on those kids who have not received any vaccination at all.
So Nigeria has the most kids who have gotten no vaccines of anywhere in the world?
Yes.
Wow. Vaccinations have become, in the U.S., politically contentious. Is that the case at all in Nigeria? Is there any controversy over them?
There is some issues with hesitancy and acceptance of vaccines in Nigeria. It's particularly with the polio vaccine about 15 years ago, which has largely been addressed by bringing in traditional and religious leaders and community leaders to be champions for the polio vaccination. COVID vaccination was also controversial. There was a lot of hesitancy around it, and we saw hesitancy in parts of the countries where vaccination was typically highly accepted. So more was in the southern area. But when it comes to measles vaccine, everybody, most mothers, community leaders, everybody knows about measles, and it's a widely accepted vaccination. So in the last campaign, we encountered some hesitancy, but it wasn't that widespread. And that was also because of the strong advocacy and communication that preceded the campaign.
Now, I understand that you were working on this vaccination effort in a part of Nigeria that is dealing with a violent insurgency, Boko Haram. How do you ensure the safety and security of both the kids you're trying to vaccinate and health workers in a place like that?
Yeah, that's correct. I supported a vaccination campaign in Borno State, and I saw firsthand what it takes to actually get kids vaccinated in parts of that state that are termed inaccessible. Inaccessible because they are under the control of insurgents. And it's a testament of the coordination and of the government and partners that they're able to devise strategies to get kids vaccinated. So there are things like hit and run, which means it's an unfortunate name, but what it actually means is that vaccination teams go into these inaccessible places under the cover of the military. So the military provides cover, they go in, vaccinate kids and come out.
Wow.
Yes. Yeah, so sometimes they also have vaccination team members who live in those occupied local government areas. And so through negotiations with the insurgents, they can come out, receive their vaccination supplies, and then go in and vaccinate kids. So the idea is that no kid is left behind, regardless of where they are.
Public health workers being escorted by the military to give vaccines. I mean, that's really striking.
Yeah.
You have mentioned a couple of things that have been done to increase trust in vaccines in Nigeria. Are there lessons that you or others working on this have learned about how to effectively roll out a program of this scale that you might take to your next assignment?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things the government and partners did before this campaign was to do an assessment, to basically survey the population to understand the sentiments around the vaccine, knowledge about rubella. And we found out that knowledge about rubella was very, very low. And it was important, therefore, to shape the advocacy, communication, and social mobilization strategies to take those gaps that were identified from the survey and implement them. So first of all, you need to know what the population knows about the vaccine, what the sentiments are, if there are any concerns, rumors. Rumor tracking is really, really important because sometimes the rumor can come from left field and be amplified by even the media. Particularly the popular media, they have to be on board. Otherwise, they may even be the one propagating the disinformation. Mm. So we need to really, really bring in a lot of champions, traditional leaders. Health workers are the number one trusted source of information. Then we have even mothers themselves. So mother talking to their friend, talking about having received the vaccine and there is no challenge to their child. Very, very important. So there are a lot of different strategies that need to be brought to bear to prepare the population before a massive rollout like this occurs.
Chizoba Wonodi is with Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Global Health.
In the worldwide race to produce renewable energy, Colombia is vying to stake a claim. A desert region in the north of the country is crucial for the nation's energy goals. The area actually juts into the Caribbean, but harnessing green energy there will require more than capturing strong winds and sun. From Riohacha, Colombia, reporter Natalie Skoland has more.
It's day one of an international renewable energy conference in this coastal city. Outside the conference center, the sun is sweltering. Temperatures reach toward 90 degrees and the air is sticky and humid. Today, I'm just grateful for the breeze, or should I say strong gusts of wind, blasting me from the ocean nearby. The conference takes place in Colombia's northeastern La Guajira region, an 18-hour drive from the country's capital. La Guajira is one of the poorest parts of Colombia. It's also home to Colombia's largest indigenous group, the Wayuu. La Guajira has long struggled with militant groups, inadequate infrastructure, and little government help. Just under half of the population here doesn't have access to electricity. A majority of rural residents don't have safe water to drink. Still, the region's stunning coastal desert landscapes have garnered attention in recent years. Tourists come for the sea, the sun, and the sand. And renewable energy companies do too. At today's conference, energy company officials, local indigenous leaders, academics, and others sit side by side. They're all here to convene around one topic: the future of renewable energy in this sun-soaked, windy part of Colombia. Felipe González Penagos is with Colombia's state-owned energy company, Ecopetrol, one of several energy companies attracted to the region.
Y cuando tú pones La Guajira y la comparas con el mundo, Mar del Norte, Patagonia, que ventea tanto, Brasil, La Guajira es world class.
Penagos says La Guajira is a world-class site for renewable energy, on par with the North Sea, Patagonia, and Brazil. One small wind farm currently generates energy in La Guajira. Penagos has his sights set on another renewable energy project at a much grander scale, 41 wind turbines spread across the desert floor. The Italian-owned Windpesci project had been stalled since 2023 after protests by indigenous communities shut the project down. Ecopetrol took over the wind project in July. Between the wind speed and lots of sunlight, this is considered one of the world's most promising locations for wind and solar energy projects. Dozens are under development in the region, and at least 40 wind farms are projected to begin operation within the next decade.
Espero que esa firma sirva para una mayor riqueza en la región y en las comunidades. Gracias.
That was Colombian President Gustavo Petro in 2023 promising what he called a just transition away from fossil fuels. But over the past few decades, justice has been hard to come by. Abram Hayariu is attending the Renewable Energy Conference as a legal representative for an association of Wayuu traditional leaders in La Guajira. He says in the past, energy companies have made little effort to understand Wayuu culture and systems of governance.
Nuestro territorio es muy sagrado, sí, para nosotros. No puede ser justo.
Our land is very sacred to us, he says. There's no justice if a company comes in, extracts natural resources from our land, and leaves behind poverty and destitution. We can only talk about justice when there are also clear benefits for the Wayuu. Ecopetrol has to prove itself.
Ecopetrol, por mucho que sea del Estado, el Estado más.
As a state-run company, he says, Ecopetrol has to set an example for future corporations that want to set up shop in La Guajira by showing respect toward the Wayuu and their customs. Ecopetrol leaders insist they're up to the task. At the conference, a Wayuu teen boy stands beside the stage drumming while young Wayuu girls in traditional flowing dresses perform a dance for the audience. It's an attempt by Ecopetrol to acknowledge the cultural roots of this region. Felipe González Penagos of Ecopetrol says they expect to restart construction in the new year and be operational by 2028. This isn't just about one wind project, Penagos says.
Y Ecopetrol tiene una visión a largo plazo de La Guajira. Windpesci puede ser la punta de lanza.
Ecopetrol has a big vision for La Guajira, Penagos says. Windpesci could be the launch pad. If we're successful in establishing respectful relations with local communities, there's more to come. The stakes, after all, are high. Projects like Windpesci promise new sources of green energy. Many locals in La Guajira hope renewable energy projects will also bring jobs and new infrastructure to their communities. Wayuu lawyer Griselda Maria Polanco Husayu lives in Petsuapa, Colombia, near the site of Windpesci. She was part of the protests a few years ago that helped shut that project down. Husayu says Ecopetrol officials have so far demonstrated a clear interest in improving life for locals through things like healthcare, water, and infrastructure.
Como apenas estamos iniciando, estamos soñando que con Ecopetrol nos vaya bien.
We're just at the beginning, she says, but we're hoping things will go well. Yabri Gonzalez is a local leader in the community of Mashumana near the Windpesci project site. For her, it can't come soon enough. She says children in her community suffer from malnutrition and a lack of access to potable water. Some locals have been forced to seek work elsewhere and leave behind families. Windpesci could make a big difference in the economic opportunities available and resources invested there.
Prácticamente nos encontramos abandonados por el Estado.
The Wayuu had been practically abandoned by the state, Gonzalez says. This project gives us hope for a better life. The conference comes to close with a final speech and plenty of applause. As I step outside, a wall of heat and humidity greets me. And so does the wind. For the world, I'm Natalie Skoland in Riohacha, Colombia.
National Geographic is watching 11 food trends in 2026. My favorite, pickles, are having a moment. Pickle flavor is in everything from cocktails to ice cream, which is where I draw the line.
Oh, Marco, I love pickles and ice cream, but I agree with you on combining them. Are there any other unusual trends that Nat Geo is tracking?
Yep. Topping their list are garum and tallow. Garum is an ancient Roman condiment made of salted and fermented fish guts. Yummy. Very umami, apparently, though. And tallow is rendered from slow-cooked meat.
Okay. Anything that is maybe a little more accessible?
Well, you got rotisserie chicken on the list. Total comfort notes there. Easy meal. Also fiber-rich foods and flavored cream cheese. Personally, I'm a fan of smoked salmon cream cheese.
Okay. That is a flavor combination I can get behind. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A team of archaeologists has discovered the oldest known cremation of a human being in Africa. The site in northern Malawi dates back more than 9,500 years. It included dozens of bone fragments believed to be the remains of an adult woman. The discovery is changing our understanding of the ancient culture and practices of this part of Africa. Jessica Thompson is an anthropologist at Yale University. She worked on the dig in Malawi with the country's Department of Museums and Monuments.
What we found at the site at first was just a whole bunch of ash. We were doing our normal excavation. We were finding normal stuff. When I say normal, I mean this is the residue of daily life. This is the animal bones from people hunting animals. This is their beads that they would wear and manufacture. And then it's the stone tools that these hunter-gatherers were using. And then suddenly we come down as we're excavating on this big, hard, cemented crust of ash. And as we keep excavating, we realize this is extremely thick. And after a couple of days of this, because we're going very slowly, somebody finds an elbow from a person. And we thought, oh, this is more than just a campfire.
Wow. What is important to know about this region in northern Malawi where this discovery happened?
This is a place that was first investigated by archaeologists in 1950. And they found a couple of human burials, and they were not cremations. And they were actually from the same site. But then back in those days, archaeologists didn't do, let me say, the most careful excavating. So you ended up with the human bones being kept, but not a lot of the cultural context that was found with them. So we went back to the site in 2016 because we wanted to find out, who were these people actually, and how did they live? Like, culturally, what can we say about them? And we also were interested in getting ancient DNA from the two burials that had been found in 1950. So the first order of business was to do that, and we were successful. The next order of business was to date these remains, and we found that they were very old. They were 8,500 years old also. And then we started excavating the site to get the cultural context, and that's when we found this.
Is it the only site of its kind in the area?
I would say so. It does seem like a very special site. And when you look at the photos, you can kind of see why, because you have this kind of flat landscape with these big inselbergs. So these are just these giant mountain-looking rocks that are isolated, and they stick up out of this landscape, and you can see them from so far away. So they clearly would have been long-term landmarks that people would have used to orient themselves. And at the bottom of this mountain, you have these small shelters that form underneath these boulders. They kind of make like a little shallow cave. And it's very clear that that's where people were gathering for many, many thousands of years. I mean, this site dates back to 21,000 years ago. And there's another site in the area we've been excavating that dates back to 37,000 years ago. So people just keep reusing these shelters. And it looks like one of the reasons that they kept going there was so that they could bury their dead.
So burials, and then there's the pyre itself. I mean, does that tell us that this cremation was for somebody, kind of an average person, or somebody special?
The pyre is the most spectacular thing about this discovery. By finding the pyre, the actual ashes where this person was burned, we were able to reconstruct at a scale of about maybe a day or two, events that unfolded bit by bit. And this is almost 10,000 years ago. So actually finding that ash and finding that pyre, that was as important as finding the remains themselves. And then, of course, when you look at the remains, you can say, well, who was this person? Why was this apparently the only person who was cremated in this whole site? There are other burials there. Why weren't they cremated?
Yeah, so give us a short version of the ritual pyre. What details have you nailed down for sure?
We know that people were making big fires at this particular place on the site, maybe 500 years before the pyre occurred. And then the pyre itself would have been huge. We're talking about at least 60 pounds of wood. We know the wood was dead wood that was collected by people because we see the little termite tubes on the wood in the ash in the pyre.
Wow.
We also see burned fungus in the pyre, and these fungi are a particular type of fungus that only occurs on like fallen dead wood. So you put together all these specialists and suddenly you're looking at layer by layer, microscopically, that the fire was lit and relit again, and the remains were placed inside. The individual has cut marks on her bones, which would suggest people were actively disarticulating and removing flesh. There's another cluster of bones where they had kind of moved them off to the side, and then those bones refit back to the original bones. So we know it's the same person. So there was a lot of active engagement with this ritual. It must have taken place certainly over hours, if not days. And we suspect it probably involved the labor of lots of people in the community. That's not really something you see in hunter-gatherer societies that are considered to be sort of small scale. And then to top it all off, a couple hundred years later, people came and they built another huge fire right on the same spot again. Again, way bigger than you would need just for a normal campfire. So we think it's some sort of living memorial.
Not to obsess on the gore, but does that removal of flesh you mentioned, does that suggest cannibalism?
I mean, that had to be a thought that we had to go through and look at the evidence, but there's a few reasons we don't think that's the case. One is that the fire is just way out of scale for what you would expect. And that's not what you do when you're actually trying to eat something. You don't just throw it into the fire. And in addition to that, we did a careful analysis of all of the animal bones that we also find at the same site. And they're burned differently, and they're fragmented differently, and they're cut differently. It really just looks like this was the kind of disarticulation that was meant to help the process of cremation along and not to help out with some sort of nutritional purpose.
This hunter-gatherer culture, do we have any sense of continuity into the culture and people living in that region today?
So there was this phenomenon called the Bantu expansion, where you have Bantu-speaking people expanding out from the northern part of Central Africa and from West Africa, and they go out and down into the southern part of Africa, and they spread all over the place. And as they do that, they bring with them herding, agriculture, ironworking, and pottery. And the hunter-gatherers who were already living in the places where these new people were coming, they usually intermarried with the newcomers. And we find that in Malawi, based on our ancient DNA evidence, that didn't really happen. It was much more of a hard replacement genetically. We don't know why, but some of the oral history in the area would suggest that there was active conflict between the hunter-gatherers and the incoming people with agriculture. And that has lasted in oral history up until the last couple of hundred years.
What strikes you as the most exciting about this find?
This particular find, I think, is exciting to me because it really shows the diversity and complexity of the way that hunter-gatherers were living in this part of the world. And that's special to me because as an Africanist archaeologist, I study the ancient record of a place that hasn't historically gotten as much attention as other places. And I think that has led people to think that maybe it's not got as interesting of a past. And in my view, it has a very interesting past. We just need to go out and find it.
Jessica Thompson is an anthropologist at Yale, telling us about the first known cremation of a human in Africa.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego.
Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. We are back tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.